You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Dear God, help us to receive and to hear your word of hope, especially in the conflicts and the remembrances of our human lives. For Christ's sake, amen. Now, I want to say one other thing about this. I get a little nervous sometimes speaking in situations because every so often someone will come up to me and they'll say, there's not enough Bible. That will happen. Someone will say, I like what you say and I think it speaks to me, but I wish you'd give us more Bible. And it's a legitimate point. And someone might be even thinking that at the end of my talk. And what I want to say to you is that the epistemological way people get truth is not through the head, but through the heart. Now, that is an unconditional statement. I will say that as an either-or statement. The way people receive powerful, applicable truth that actually has the potential to change their lives is when it comes to the heart initially, and then it goes to the head. Now, what people in the Reformed tradition will say, and I've heard it all my life, and I understand it, and I respect it, and I always agree with these guys. I mean, that's the funny thing is, I always agree with what my PCA friends are saying, but I'm saying, but are you really getting through to the reality of the loss and the disappointment and the fragility of your hearers? Because what you seem to think is that if I hear something in my head, it will then change my will, and then my mind, my heart will catch up with my will. Have you ever heard that? In other words, if I think it with my head, and I really believe it, and I act on it, my heart will catch up. Now, in my opinion, that is an anthropological mistake. I wish it were true. It would make it, but it doesn't allow for the unconscious. It doesn't allow for the fact that so much of what people do is doesn't fit in any logical model. I mean, why did you marry the person that you married at least the first time? One thing I know, that if your mother or your father said anything negative about the person that you brought to your house as your candidate to be married, if they said anything negative, you would marry the person that afternoon. And believe me, if you've had grown children, you've had experience with this. The only sure way to get your daughter to marry the least possible raunchy, awful person is to simply tell her the obvious facts that are before everybody's eyes. And believe me, that afternoon, she'll tell you, well, actually, we already are married. Now, all that is to say, and there's a lot of reasons why people do that, but there are fundamental decisions that people make and fundamental conditions that people experience that are non-rational. They're under their heart. I just feel it. And so the way to communicate, in my experience, to a person is to try to reach where we really live and not start here. Obviously, I believe there's a connection, and it's wonderful to have rational elucidations of what your own experience has encountered. But I'll go so far as to say it never begins there. And just look at your life. Look at where you went to college. Look at who your friends were. Look at who, again, most importantly, who you married or who you dated. It's almost always in some kind of other realm. And we know from the law and the gospel that as soon as we tell somebody no, especially if they're a child, they immediately do the opposite. It's just a law of human nature. I didn't make it up. I wish it weren't true. I honestly wish that people could be connected and helped through their heads. Then think of how easy it would be to convince your child to do what your own experience has taught you is essential. And if they don't do it, they'll have 10 years of total and complete disaster until they find some kind of hope. So that's why I start with the heart. But it's all rooted in the belief that the Christian faith is about God's love for us prior to our love for him. Now that's the governing kind of little preamble to this talk. The funny thing is it lines up with everything the book of Romans says. It lines up with 1 Peter and 2 Peter and Philippians. It lines up with it. Luther said it lined up with absolutely everything in the Bible with the exception of three verses. And he was willing to let three verses kind of hang in there because you don't build your entire life on one tiny email you get. So this is basically an attempt to understand the course of human experience and individual human life in light of the principle that change is wrought by prior love. Obviously, you thought of Stevie Winwood, right? Higher Love. And I used to remember, I mean, here, who here hasn't gone for years and years in their car, at least if you're a guy, listen, oh, honey, that's prior Higher Love by Stevie Winwood. Oh, traffic. Oh, my gosh. I nicknamed the song immediately Prior Love. And then it's beautiful. Now, that is a way of starting out to say what happens to change a person from a life based upon mental planning to a life based upon an acceptance of prior acceptance and prior love. What happens to change a person in life? Now, let me say how this goes, and it's all in the little book. Life is divided into three sections for people. Life is divided. The first section is when you're born and you're a child. And the first section is when you are receiving, you come in with a psychogenetic reservoir, but you're receiving a million impressions and you're finding who you are. You don't have the slightest idea. And that's why a child is so precious. A child is like Jay preached, Jesus said, this is precious. The first third is where the tablet of your life is written on. It's where the most wonderful relationships are birthed. It's where the most difficult and inured disappointments are birthed. And it's where the patterns of loss and repatriation and recidivism and trying harder and habitude and compulsion are birthed, usually in a some problem. I like to always quote Aretha Franklin, "The House That Jack Built." Remember that song from 1968? This is the house that Jack built. Now listen to that song. It's actually about something completely different, but it's one of her great songs. But your life is the house that Jack built until you're about sort of 20 or 21, and this is what you're starting out with. Now that's happened, and you're there, and you bring all the things you bring to your future life is this house that Jack built, and it has the curses and the hurts and also the gifts and the hopes and the dreams and the possibilities and the limitations. It's all there. The second third is when you prosecute that life in the world. You go forward with that life in this world with all the circumstances and contingencies and problems that life presents to us. So you have the house that Jack built, and then Jack is going out there to deal with all the outward circumstances, people, possibilities, situations. And that's when that's when the wrong idea of life takes hold and captures the person from the first third. Let me say how this goes. I was in Germany just a few weeks ago to be at Herr Moltmann's funeral in Tübingen. Remember, he and his wife came to the Advent, and everybody who lived in Tübingen came to the Advent in many years. And it was a little funny because you had to translate there. It didn't quite come off, but sometimes it did. I'll never remember Herr Bayer saying, "Ja, das ist hier ein Wunder. Es ist hier die Laien." What he meant was, it's wonderful being here. The laity, the lay people. He met so many people who were sort of real theologians in their heart. He'd never run into that in his life in Germany as a theologian. And then Frau Moltmann said something improper from the pulpit. Some of you may remember. She used an expression that you should never use from the pulpit, not realizing it, and we forgave her. One of Herr Moltmann's most important, one of his most important sayings is, we think in the second third of life, that's my addition, we think that life is a matter of action consequence. In fact, life is a matter of death resurrection. Oh my gosh, you know, let me repeat that. We think that life is a matter of action consequence. In fact, we understand as Christians, and seeing life as it is in light of God's mercy, my addition, that it's a matter of death resurrection. And apply that to your life. Because what often happens is in the second third of life, you come up against something that is no longer susceptible to correction by means of action consequence. You've tried. You've been to a million therapists. You've been to a million and helping agencies. You've made this and that. You've done everything in your power. But someone that you love is still compulsively destructive or self-destructive. Or you yourself have a pattern of sort of drop of a hat anger, road rage type anger that doesn't seem to give way given all the advice and the counsel and the wisdom and the work. And then what happens is, this especially happens in your profession. For men, I mean, for everybody, I shouldn't have said it, but I'd meant it. Your profession suddenly goes belly up. You've worked so hard. You've given it everything you had. And because of somebody's Machiavellian vengeance out there, some person who you had no idea that all that time they were rubbing their hands waiting to get your job or to attack you, and suddenly you're the object of a lawsuit, or you find out at a board meeting something, or you get a letter that changes everything, or an email that changes everything, like you're fired. And you then find that action consequence is mistaken. Remember, I'm not saying it's bad. We all do it. But it's mistaken. It's a false diagnosis of what is required. And what happens, and I'm begging you, if you're in the second third of life, which is about 20 to 60, and it can vary, but if you're in the second third of life, it would be so wonderful if you learned this important lesson about death resurrection rather than action consequence. It doesn't come naturally to people in their second third. You're raising children, you're wiped out, you're exhausted, you're making headway, but so I don't expect you to believe it, but it's better to believe it in your second third, because in your third third it will become sadly 100% too obvious. And this will be when you get sick, or someone you love has a grievous illness, and all of a sudden she's not who she was. Or your own body is suddenly in the ICU, given a completely out of the blue condition that you never knew you had. And or your father or mother, who you loved so much, have to go into hospice care, let alone an Alzheimer's unit. And that will definitely tell you. So I guess my first point would be, wouldn't it be great if someone in the second third of life could find out and live earlier through the death resurrection model? Now, there's something else. I've just got 2.5 points to make today. One that I've made and another one that I'm hoping to make. People often, again, if you're not in the third third, it doesn't matter, but if you're anywhere near the third third, you'll have heard this question. Well, I know, I hear you're retired. What are you doing with yourself? It's a compulsive thing. They can't help it. You know what I mean? It's like COVID. I mean, it's a compulsive thing. You can't help it. And, Paul, are you writing? If anyone asks me that question again, I won't get mad. I'll just collapse like Dorothy's the witch. You know what I mean? But that's what, in my case, they'll say, what are you writing? And in your case, they'll say, what are you doing? What's this, what you're supposed to say? Well, I'm building on some of the challenges that I had in the last 20 years of my career, and I've become a mentor for young advertising executives who are just lining up to talk to me. Zero. St. Stephen Sewickley, a parish not unlike this parish, had this big program because they all had these retired Pittsburgh so-called executives living in Sewickley who were desperate for something to do, and they had this big program mentoring mentoring younger executives. And exactly how many people, it was a large parish, how many people came to that program in 2 years? Well, I'll tell you how many. Two. Because no one who's 35, who's normal, unless they've heard, is going to go to somebody who's 70 who's out to pasture. I mean, they may think they should, they might like to in theory, but they won't. They just won't. I wish they would. This is true of emeritus professors. This is, I mean, they're the worst. But anyway, so the point is, what I'm trying to, my first point was about death resurrection versus action consequence. Is my second point is, where does purpose come from? And this applies both to people in the second third, not the first. The people in the first third should be completely exempt from all these questions. But people in the second and third, where does my purpose come from? Where do I actually find something that I want to do, not something that I ought to do or something that everybody else thinks I should do, but what I actually want to do? And the irony is, there are exceptions in practice, but it almost always comes, purpose almost always comes from a prior love that comes to you from outside yourself. That's whether you're 25 or 55 or even 85. Purpose comes from prior love, which automatically and spontaneously endows you with a desire to love. And as you know, real creativity is founded on love. Really successful businesses are founded on people who love what they're doing. That's true. There are a few exceptions. But really successful businesses. I remember I was somewhere once when I was talking. I was in law school at that time for 3 days. And I asked someone, I said, well, are there all the young men I know who are going to law school right now, they just want to achieve, or they think that's the way to get ahead in the world or New York, and they want to make money. And I said, are there any exceptions? And this real old guy from, he was a retired partner from Sullivan and Cromwell, but he wasn't that old. And he said to me, he said, yes, every so often you meet a fellow who's interested in legal problems for their own sake. And I met a few. Have you met any? I mean, sure, there are probably all sorts of people here who are lawyers or attorneys who are interested in legal problems for their own sake. And it can't be beat. It's like meeting someone who's interested in a subject for its own sake, you know, who's actually interested in car maintenance. And you occasionally do meet people. Why did I look in a certain direction? But the power of motivation comes from someone who loves you or shows an interest and a non-rejecting interest in your well-being, and that inevitably transforms. Now, I'm going to give you three examples, and then I'm going to close with a passage in the scripture, which expresses this, in my opinion, far better than I. I'm sure you love Paul McCartney. Who doesn't love Paul McCartney? And he's had some bad luck in his marriages, the second one especially. Now it's okay. But the first one, what people didn't realize, they always assume that Paul McCartney is the least neurotic of all human beings. And he is. He's unbelievably together person. He has a rod, straight and narrow, what is it, ganz vom Recht, what do they say in German? He is a person who is very, very consistently creative and interested and has his feet on the ground. But people didn't know during the later part of the Beatles that he had depression. And in fact, some days Paul McCartney could not get out of bed in the morning. And that is true. Now, there was a rather ambitious New York woman that I have a connection with historically. I never met her, but I have a connection with her historically. And her name was Linda Eastman. And Linda Eastman was an ambitious, she came from a privileged background, but she was ambitious and a very good photographer. And she sort of, as she said it in her own words, she kind of wanted to meet Paul McCartney. I mean, hasn't there been somebody you'd rather meet than anyone else in the whole world? But don't tell me there's not. She finally got to meet him. And they were sitting at kind of a function, and he sort of liked her. And he said to her, well, Ms. Eastman, in fact, There are days when I can't get out of bed in the morning. And Linda Eastman just looked at him straight in the eye and said, oh, that's allowed. That's all she said. She said, oh, that's allowed. He decided to marry her on the basis of that single statement. Now, have you ever had a situation like that? When someone has given you, I mean, this is literally true. It's in the biography. It's all out there now. She died tragically, as you know. And his last words to her are very powerful. If you want to have a real way of how to help a person who's dying at the very last moment, I would have added something, but it's still good. But she just said, well, that's allowed. Like that. I want to marry you. Now, can't you understand that? Almost everybody you know, and then look what happened. I mean, he did, Baby, I'm Amazed. That came out of that one contact. And if you do Baby, I'm Amazed, your life is made forever. I mean, is there a better song in the world? So what happens is that the ability to love, and this is true in the Christian gospel, mammoth, the ability to love hinge and to serve and to create and to have purpose hinges on how well you are loved. Now, there's I often quote the song, which is exactly this teaching. And this is the heart of the gospel. But all I'm trying to do is trying to pipe it into you in terms of the emotional life of belovedness and serving and love and purpose. And many of us are wandering around like chickens with our head cut off, you know. Am I writing? Well, I did, but I didn't decide to. I didn't decide to write that book. What about you in your current life? Suddenly you find yourself doing something very interesting and the only you can do. But did you decide to do it? Probably not. And this is a song that Dean Martin sang. You've all heard it before. In 1956. You're nobody till somebody loves you. You're nobody till somebody cares. You may be king. You may possess the world and its gold. But gold won't bring you happiness when you're growing old. Finally, the world still's the same. You never change it. As sure as the stars shine above, you're nobody till somebody loves you. Now, I don't know. I don't know if you know, like that song, but there's a profound truth in life. I would say it's the profoundest truth of all life. We naturally would ground it eternally and beyond all human relationships in the love of God. But you're nobody till somebody loves you. And I'm going to read something from the little book I wrote and then close with something from the gospel. Let's call the first point I made, getting your life on the right foot, which is sadly but powerfully death resurrection rather than action consequence. The second point is what moves a person to work and to joyful creative enterprise is prior love. And if you are loved by somebody that way right now, I mean, I'm not saying who it could be. It could take a number of possible embodiments. But if you're loved by someone in that way, in a strange sort of way, there's nothing you can't do. I mean, it'll be your own. It'll be distinctive, but there's very little that will be ruled out if you're loved substantially, first by somebody like Jean Valjean in Les Misérables, who reflected Christ's love to this broken man and changed everything. And that's the second point. You're somebody when you're loved. And then I'm going to finish on it. But I'm going to read one passage. Then it's on page 135 in this book, and I'm not selling the book. I don't think I get a penny for any book that is sold, do I, Mary? It goes to Mockingbird, buy it. But every so often I say, well, at least maybe a quarter. Now, it covers their cost. This is it. I'm reading a quote, then I'll finish with a Bible verse. The second third of life, your grown-up adult years, were spent mostly in pursuing false lead after false lead, false step after false track after false glimpse. Oh, boomer, you fill in the blanks. You were chronically in search of an object to satisfy the grasping, needy, despairing part of you. But you also always remembered something important and something non-repeatable, the earliest oneness. The only place where that seemed to be approximated was usually the connection you had with a person or persons with whom you fell in love. And then I talk a little bit about that. For many people, the pathway instantly to work, like Paul McCartney, is the experience of being loved for who you are, not for some picture of you are, not the non-neurotic bass player for the greatest group in the world who never stopped creating, but a man who couldn't get out of bed. And believe me, some of us here, even the most together seeming and perhaps together being people, have moments where they feel like Paul McCartney did. Now I'm finishing. So now, I write, you have gotten to retirement age. Money didn't do it for you. Status didn't do it. Control did it a little. But you're not quite as sharp as you used to be. It's very difficult about having lunch with people because when I forget a name, you know, and I forget who wrote a certain book, you know, control did a little, but you're not quite as sharp as you were. You can't help falling behind a little now. So if you are wise, the consuming interests of the second third of your life have faded in force. But unfortunately, those interests are still trying to con you. They are certainly conning an old college friend of mine who just has to be catered to as someone important when she travels, if it means she has to give away all her money to an institution so they will fly her there in order, actually, cajole more funds out of her. False promises from the second third of life can haunt you during the last third. But, I'm almost finished, death can come suddenly too. And you're unprepared. Boomer, get prepared. At one stunning, unrepeatable moment, which often comes by surprise, the dedications of your second third of life will prove sterile. They will evanesce, leaving only a bewildered you in the moment following your death in the presence of the light that is the light of men. I don't believe I wrote that. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for sharing. But if it weren't true, I wouldn't read it. In my experience. So I want to finish by quoting T.S. Eliot, who wrote the concluding line of this little talk, and I'll do next week about assimilating bad things that have happened. Assimilating for the sake of healing bad things that have happened. And the third class is about heaven. What is heaven like? What can we say about heaven? Because I have some thoughts. But In Galatians, Paul wrote this. The desires of the flesh are such and such. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. For the fruit of the Spirit is love, peace, joy, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such, there is no law. There's nobody asking you, what are you doing? How are you making your time outside of golf? What are you doing? Isn't it sort of hard given all the other things? Against such, there is no law. And that's really what I wanted to leave you with, because T.S. Eliot, in his wonderful fourth of the four quartets, says this, and this is the end of this little talk, old men ought to be explorers. That's always a line that got to me when I first read it. Old men ought to be explorers. And it's divine. Who said it? Somebody said that was a moment of divine inspiration. Because I can't be an explorer because I'm told I should be an explorer. I can't be doing this or that because I think I should be doing this or that. But when I'm loved securely by God in the first place, by Mary in the second place, and hopefully by a sense of beneficent community, I will in fact become an explorer. It's an indicative, not an imperative. And that goes for everybody here, male and female, whatever age you are. Thank you for listening. And the next week we'll talk about finding relief and closure and assimilation from the hurts of your own life. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.